Thing I need to do is check to see if the microphone is working. Okay. I think you could hear me anyway, but the recording needs it to be mic'd. Okay. So the next thing I should do is thank the organizers for the invitation to speak, and then I should make a bit of an apology that a few people in the room will have heard most of this talk and seen some of these slides before, because this is the same set of slides, suitably modified, that I used to give a talk at IPAM about 3 weeks ago. And, however, I did promise Renata that the talk would not be exactly the same, so there is, in fact, one key section at the very end which is different and which actually describes results that were obtained since I gave the talk at IPAM. So, but anyway, so when I say recent, some of these results will be, the very last bit will be on results that are quite recent. Okay, but let's go ahead. So let's start with the basic setup. The basic setup is that you have some algebraic variety over some finite field, and I'll come back to what this should be in a moment. But you have some algebraic variety over some finite field. Q is always going to be the cardinality of my finite field, and P is always going to be the characteristic of said finite field. The zeta function of x can be defined as a formal power series where you count the number of rational points on the variety over the field fq to the n, and then you take this sort of generating function assembled out of those, you sort of sum tn over n exponentiate. You can also write this as an Euler product over the closed points of x, or if you like, the Galois orbits of fq bar points of x, but this is the, so I lose my, I might have switched to the other one then. Is this even visible in the back? Okay, so this is the most convenient form for calculations. And the fundamental fact about this zeta function, zeta x of t, is that this power series represents a rational function of t with integer coefficients that was originally proved by Dworck and was reinterpreted. Ah, yes, that's better. I wanted a little pointy one. That's a little blue. Okay. I think maybe I lost the battery on this. So this formal power series represents a rational function with integer coefficients that was originally proved by Dworck and was reinterpreted by Grothendieck in a matter that I'll mention shortly. And there are some additional restrictions on where the zeros and poles of this thing can lie. This is Deligne's proof of the last of the Vey conjectures, but for the moment it's not so critical exactly what those restrictions are. As an example, and also because most of the talk is going to be about curves, I'll say explicitly what happens when you have a curve of genus G, and curve here means it's a smooth, projective, geometrically irreducible curve. It's like a Riemann surface except it's over a finite field. X is a curve of genus G, and then the zeta function will have the form, in the denominator it'll have 1 minus t and 1 minus qt, and then in the numerator, it'll have this polynomial p of degree twice the genus. P will have integer coefficients. It will have a constant coefficient 1 because the first coefficient, the constant coefficient of this power series is visibly 1. So p of 0 is 1. P is a polynomial of degree 2g. Its roots lie in the circle. Absolute value of z is q to the minus a half. And there's also a symmetry between coefficients on either end, but we don't need to worry about that right now. This is all due to Vey, who sort of first introduced this concept. And the relevance to cryptography is that when you start with a curve, you very naturally make a group out of it, which you can either think of as the group of FQ rational points of the Jacobian variety. So the Jacobian is an abelian variety. So it's a group object in the category of algebraic varieties. So it's an algebraic group of dimension G the genus, and its group of FQ rational points has order P of 1, where P is this polynomial. So if you know what the zeta function is, then you know what the order of this group is. You can also interpret this as the group of divisor classes on the curve, so pick not degree zero divisor classes. Of course, if g equals 1, that's the most familiar case, then x is an elliptic curve, And J of X is just X itself. So X actually carries the group structure in that case. And so why do we care about algebraic groups in cryptography? Well, we want to build something, that some sort of crypto system that takes as its hardness assumption the hardness of doing discrete logarithms in whatever group we're using. And this gives us, so this curve gives us the group J. And what do we need to do? We need to check whether it has a large prime factor so that we know how secure the system is, right? Because all that matters for the hardness of discrete log is the largest prime factor dividing the order of the group. So the typical thing is you have some curve and you want to use the hardness of the discrete log problem in the Jacobian of that curve as your hardness assumption. And so you check the order of the group by somehow computing the zeta function, and then you can try factoring that number and seeing whether it's mostly prime. So I should say this is the last appearance of any cryptography in the talk. The rest of this talk will really be about the problem, sort of a purely number theoretic problem, of how do you actually compute this zeta function for various interesting classes of curves. I might mention some examples that are more specifically motivated by cryptography, but from here on out, it's mostly a problem about this question, algorithmic number theory. And here's an explicit framing of this question. So the zeta function problem for a class of varieties, so you fix some class of varieties you're interested in, and then the problem is, given an so this class of varieties should be things that you can describe explicitly in terms of their equations. So given an explicit x, determine the zeta function. And so typical classes where you consider this problem, well, the earliest class where it was considered particularly in connection with cryptography was elliptic curves over some finite field. But nowadays, people are getting restless, and so they also think about hyperelliptic curves of, well, typically low genus in cryptography, but I can ask this question for any genus. Or you could ask about other interesting classes of varieties, like smooth plane curves of a fixed degree. Right? Maybe you want to generate non-hyperelliptic curves of genus 3. You could make those as smooth plane curves of degree 4. I don't think anybody has tried to do that for crypto, but maybe you could. The reason why these classes are good classes for this problem is, well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that it's easy to write down random members of these classes. For anybody who likes algebraic geometry in the audience, the reason is that these are parameterized by unirational moduli spaces. So there's a sort of universal family of these objects of each of these types, which is sort of a rational variety, and so you can write down elements by just picking parameters in a suitable way. So you can easily make random curves of any of these types. This problem isn't explicitly restricted to curves, I should say. These examples are all curves, and I'll mention one or two higher dimensional examples later, but mostly I'll talk about curves. And another thing that's helpful is that in each of these situations, I know something about the shape of the zeta function. So I know what the degree of the top and bottom factors are, and I know some fixed factors because, for instance, for a curve, I have this particular shape where this thing has fixed degree and these two factors are fixed. And that was just using the fact that they're curves of a given degree. If you fix extra structure, you might pick up extra fixed factors in the numerator, but never mind that for now. And so how does one typically approach this problem? Well, there are some sort of generic approaches. You could actually count the number of elements in this set, the number of rational points on x over f q to the n for various small values of n by actually doing some sort of exhaustive search for these things. So the number of values of n you need is basically the number of coefficients that you don't know a priori, so that you can have enough linear equations to determine the coefficients. You almost never want to do this except in extremely simple situations where x is relatively simple and q is small. Typically, there are much better things to do, but you might as well try it at first. For curves, you have the so-called baby step, giant step method of introduced, I guess, by Shanks, where you use the fact that, so this is really only for computing the order of the Jacobian, although you could turn it into a point counting algorithm, I won't get into that. But let's say what you really want is the order of the Jacobian. Well, you know this order is bounded in this interval because of what I said about the roots of the polynomial P and the fact that the Jacobian order is P of 1. That forces the Jacobian order to be bounded in this interval, and so that the width of this is something like Q to the, so these numbers here are about 2G. Yeah, sorry, these are 2Gs here. So the size of these numbers is Q to the G, but the width of the interval is about Q to the G over 2. So you have an order, you know, the order is about some size n, but it's constrained in an interval of length root n. And so there's this baby step, giant step method using purely that information that you can use to recover the order. And again, that's a sort of generic approach. It uses very little information about the underlying algebraic geometry, just information about the order of the Jacobian. There are some other techniques. So I'm going to mention. So there's at least one more technique that works sort of in general. That's Skov's method, which I'll come back to in a moment. But in small characteristic, you have a whole lot of extra techniques. So of course. The prototypical example of small characteristic is characteristic 2, but actually small characteristic is not as small as you think, and I'll come back to how small is small at the very end of the talk. But if the characteristic is reasonably small, you have additional techniques, primarily for the purposes of this talk, the use of what's called p-adic cohomology, which is what I'll be talking about in the next few slides. There are some other techniques that are available. So for instance, I think that maybe the first p-adic technique that really had any legs was Sato's canonical lift method, where you have an ordinary elliptic curve and you compute the Serre-Tate canonical lift, which has the same endomorphism ring, and then you could just read off the zeta function from because the Frobenius actually lifts upstairs, so you can sort of directly read off its characteristic polynomial. So that was a really nice method for ordinary elliptic curves in small characteristic. There's also the arithmetic geometric mean iteration suggested by Mestre, which is really useful in characteristic 2, although I think there are some variations in higher characteristics. I think David Cole maybe worked out some higher characteristic versions. I mean, you still want the characteristic to be small because there's a polynomial dependence in P in all of these techniques. So Mestre's AGM method is good for ordinary curves of certainly genus 1, and I think maybe it's been worked out for genera 2 and 3, at least over fields of characteristic 2. There's also a class of methods which, in the previous version of this talk, I talked about these, but in the interest of, I had to shrink it from a 60-minute talk to a 50-minute talk and get in some new material, so I'm going to drop the discussion of this deformation method except to say what it is in about one sentence. Alan Lauder's original... Alan Lauder's original suggestion was that actually, in some cases, it might be easier, instead of computing an individual zeta function, it's sometimes easier to compute a one-parameter family, the zeta functions for a one-parameter family of varieties all at once. The reason is because there's some extra data you get in the family, what's called a Picard-Fuchs equation, that you can use to shortcut some of the techniques. So I'm not going to talk about this, but... it should be pointed out that this deformation technique is not purely theoretical, actually. The current version of MAGMA has an implementation by Hendrik Ubrechts of a deformation technique, but it's kind of out of the stream of what I'm going to talk about here, so I'm going to leave it at that. There's one technique that's known to work pretty well, better than generic methods, in large characteristic, and that is Skov's original algorithm for computing the zeta function of an elliptic curve, or computing the order of elliptic curve, which turns out to be equivalent. And that is to compute modulo L for many small primes L. You basically write down the L torsion of the elliptic curve explicitly and read off the Frobenius action on that. And that works even for, you know, large P. So you can take P of cryptographic size, and you can actually do Scope's method to compute the order of a random elliptic curve over a GFP. This just depends rather badly on genus. So it was proposed to do this in higher genus by Jonathan Pila, and his method was at least worse than exponential in the genus. I forget how bad it was, but it was pretty bad. There has been some progress made on this in genus 2, I gather. I guess Gaudry has worked on this, and I guess where is Dan Bernstein's student, maybe? Nikki? You're working on this as well? Or okay. So the progress is, I believe, being made on getting this to work in genus 2. But it's not so easy. And this is a more of a complexity theory question. I don't know how much practical import it has. So it's known that finding the zeta function for a curve of genus G over FQ is polynomial time individually in G and in log Q. So if you fix G and vary Q, then Pila's theorem asserts that you get a polynomial time algorithm. And if you fix Q and vary G, then p-adic chromological techniques can be used to prove this. But if you vary these both simultaneously, there's no algorithm that's known to be polynomial time that in both variables, unless you give yourself a quantum computer, which I guess if I was here 3 weeks ago, I could have done that. But today I can't, so I won't. So in the rest of the time, I'm going to talk about the framework in which p-adic cohomology is being used in this talk, which is introduced by Motzke and Wachtitzer. And then I'll talk about the original example of how to use p-adic cohomology to compute zeta functions. This is on hyperelliptic curves. And then I'll talk about various extensions of that work. So this is supposed to be something like, you know, Sidious, Altius, Fortius, more curves, higher dimensions, and larger characteristic. So there are various improvements and generalizations. And it's actually become a pretty active area. Okay, so what's the setup? So there's nothing p-adic yet. This is just cohomology in zeta functions. So the typical way one studies zeta functions is to interpret them as coming from certain linear transformations. So you construct from out of your variety, which is some sort of horribly nonlinear thing, you make some sort of linear data. You make you have some sort of cohomology theory that turns this thing into some collection of vector spaces over some field K, each of which is equipped with a linear transformation F such that this thing holds, that this point count is given by an alternating sum of traces of the nth power of your F on this HI. So this is supposed to be like the Lefschetz trace formula in topology, and indeed this was what Zay had in mind when he originally started looking at these zeta functions. He was thinking that actually maybe you can interpret this. This is supposed to be the number of fixed points of the nth power of the absolute Frobenius map on X. Because X is defined over FQ, you can raise everything in the world to the Qth power, and you get ring homomorphism. So you get a map from the variety to itself. And so that the fixed points of that are supposed to be counted by alternating sum of traces of the action of the corresponding linear transformation on cohomology. This has this formal consequence. If this is true, and these spaces are all finite dimensional, then the zeta function is given by a alternating product, so you have sort of plus and minus signs on the factors, but an alternating product of these characteristic polynomials of F on these vector spaces. So that's the main thing to take away from this slide, is that you're looking for situations where you can interpret the zeta function factors as the characteristic polynomials of some linear transformation on some vector space, and hopefully the linear transformation and the vector space are things you can compute explicitly. That is not really the case in the original example of these cohomologies, which is what Grothendieck introduced, the so-called étale cohomology, or L-adic cohomology, because it takes coefficients in the L-adic numbers, where L is your favorite prime other than P. This is somehow implicit in Scope's algorithm, that you are essentially computing this L-adic cohomology for an elliptic curve. It's actually canonically something that comes from ZL. It's really a module over the L-adic integers, which you then tensor up to QL. And if you reduce it mod L, you get the thing that Scope is computing, the L division polynomial. So you're implicitly using L-adduct cohomology for many different primes L in SCOFT's algorithm. You also, if you know anything about Edick-Subin's method, which is a sort of a generalization of SCOFT's algorithm, Edick-Subin and his collaborators, I don't know if any of them are here, prove that if you give yourself a fixed modular form, say the Ramanujan modular form delta, you could compute its Fourier coefficients. Given the factorization of n, you can compute the nth Fourier coefficient of that in time polynomial in log n. Of course, you need the factorization. And that is based on a variation of SCOFT's algorithm where you work mod L for various primes L. But computationally, this is very, very difficult to do, except in the case of SCOFT's algorithm, and to the extent that there is progress in genus 2, this is really, really hard to do in practice. And the main reason is because this cohomology theory comes to you in a very non-explicit form. You can write down, in some sense, you can write down elements of a tall cohomology really easily, but it's very hard to tell whether an element that you've written down is zero. And it's not so easy to work with a vector space and do linear algebra if you can't tell whether things are zero or not. So that's a big problem. So instead, the approach that I'm going to take in the rest of this talk is to use a completely different theory that has some formal similarities but is much more explicitly computable. So this was introduced by Monsky and Washnitzer. It's based on ideas introduced by Dworkin in his original proof of the rationality of zeta functions. This is going to be a cohomology theory which sort of takes values in vector spaces over a field that I call QQ, which is the finite unramified extension of the p-adic numbers with residue field FQ. So if you want to think of Q equals P, then I'm just working with the p-adic numbers. But here, yeah, there's a difference between the L-adic theory and this theory. Here, the field actually depends on which finite field I'm using. Whereas in a tall cohomology, you fix an L, and then you always get vector spaces over QL, no matter how big the extension of the prime field you're working over. I should point out, when you do computations with p-adic numbers, it's very much like the real numbers. You only can specify things approximately. Most p-adic numbers cannot be written down exactly because they're given as infinite series and powers of p. And so you can't determine them explicitly unless they happen to be, say, algebraic numbers. And then you can kind of keep track of them explicitly. So in particular, you can't really hope to compute even if you can explicitly represent this vector space and the Frobenius action, which in fact you can't actually compute this action exactly. What you can hope to do is take some basis. The basis, it turns out, you can write down exactly in most of the cases we're interested in. But so you have some basis. The action of F will be some matrix, but you can only approximate that matrix up to some p-adic precision. And so you have to keep track of how much precision you need to get at the end of the calculation in order to recover the zeta function, because the coefficients of the zeta function are actual integers, and you know something about how big they are. So you really only need to know the modulo a certain power of p. So you should keep track of how big that power of p is. So that's step one, is figure out how much precision you need to end the calculation with. And then you also need to worry about loss of precision during the calculation. So you need to know how much p-adic precision you need to start the calculation with. In particular, knowing how much precision you lose in the calculation is quite a tricky issue that I don't want to talk about at all here. But a lot of the hard work in this theory is monitoring that precision loss. But I'm just going to ignore that for now to give you a more conceptual idea of what's going on. One other detail that needs to be kept track of is that this theory, Monsky-Washnitzer cohomology, is only defined for affine varieties, whereas in practice, what typically comes up is you have an elliptic curve, not most of an elliptic curve, but the whole elliptic curve is what you're interested in. And that's not going to be affine, usually, but you can take out some lower dimensional subvariety to leave behind an affine thing. So, for instance, if you start with an elliptic curve and you take out the point at infinity, what's left is an affine variety. So if you can separately compute the zeta function of the affine part using some sort of cohomology, and then deal with the part that you took out, which will be of lower dimension, so presumably it's easier to deal with. So if you can deal with these two pieces separately, the zeta function it's multiplicative in this sense. If x is a disjoint union of u and y, then a zeta function is the product of the zeta functions in U and Y. And that's a formal consequence of the definition I gave at the very beginning in terms of point counts, because the point counts of X are just the sums of the point counts on U and Y. So for instance, yeah, if X is, say, the hyperelliptic curve, Y squared equals P of X in P2, you could take out just the point at infinity, or points at infinity, depending on whether there are one or two points at infinity, but you might take Y to be larger as well, and that's convenient for computations, as we'll see in a moment. Okay, so how do you actually use this p-adic cohomology stuff to compute zeta functions is a very rough outline. There's a lot of details that I'm skipping over, but anyway. So the first thing is you start out with a variety, which I'm going to assume is smooth and affine for the moment, so that I can do this calculation. It starts out being defined over a finite field. I have to lift it to a variety defined over the ZQ, which is the ring of integers in QQ. So it's an unramified extension of the p-adic integers, ZP. There's some fine print. This lift has to be chosen sensibly. So it should be a complement of a relative normal crossing divisor in a smooth proper scheme over ZQ. But never mind. It'll be in the examples, it'll be clear what I mean by a good lift. And that's all that matters for the moment. And then so you sort of pick a sensible lift of your thing up to characteristic zero. And then you have to lift the Frobenius map. You might as well lift the p-power Frobenius map first and then raise it to a power to get the q-power map. That's the p-power map is not actually linear over fq, but never mind. So here, this fine print is actually much more important than this fine print. This fine print is that you don't usually get an algebraic lift. So if you take a curve, say, over fq, and you lift it to the zq, to another curve, you typically don't actually have a map from the upstairs curve to itself that lifts Frobenius. You might get lucky. If the curve had genus 1 and you chose the lift to be the serrated canonical lift, if you had an ordinary thing downstairs, then there would be a Frobenius upstairs, and that's how Sato's method works. But in general, that lift doesn't exist as an algebraic thing. So it's going to be given as some sort of p-adically convergent series. It's actually what's called an overconvergent series. But you'll see this explicitly when I write out an example, that you don't actually get an algebraic lift. You get an infinite series, which kind of makes sense because you're trying to compute something which is only a which is only a matrix of p-adic numbers, not a matrix of algebraic numbers. Okay, so you write down that you approximately write down this Frobenius. You have to truncate things because you are not writing down infinite precision numbers. But so you write down some approximation of Frobenius, and you see how it acts on Derome cohomology, on so-called algebraic Derome cohomology, which again you'll see explicitly in a moment. And you sort of do this. I'll mention in passing, this is sort of a joke comment, because pairings are so trendy in cryptography, I thought I should mention, there is a pairing on this Derome cohomology called the cup product, and I don't know if it's actually useful for these zeta function calculations. I think it might give you a constant factor speed up if you actually were to incorporate it, but anyway. Okay, so here's an example to actually show you how this stuff works, and the main point of this example is to convince you that really this is an explicitly computable theory. You can actually do the calculations that I've outlined in schematic form. So let's say X is a hyperelliptic curve. I'm going to assume that I'm in characteristic not 2 so that I can write my hyperelliptic curve as Y squared equals P of X. And I'm assuming the so-called imaginary case that P is monic of degree 2G plus 1. So G is my genus. In general, I should also take the real case where this polynomial has degree 2g plus 2, but for simplicity, I'm going to skip that for now. Let's see. I'm going to take out the points. Oh, that's a typo I didn't fix in the previous slide, is it? From the previous talk. So I'm taking out, what I want to do is take out the Weierstrass points. So I'm going to take out the point at infinity, and then I'm going to invert y. So the coordinate ring of this thing has generators x, y, and z, which is the inverse of y, or z, which is the inverse of y. But the complete curve has genus G, and so now I have to, so that's my variety I'm interested in. Now I'm going to lift it, so I'm just going to take a monic lift of this polynomial P. So it's going to preserve the degree, because it's monic, and that was monic. And I'm going to lift Frobenius as follows. X will just lift to X will map to X to the P, so that's completely algebraic. But Y has to go to something which is truly p-adic. So it's Y if you disentangle what this is just, this expression is merely there because the image of y squared has to be the image of p of x. So if you disentangle what that means, it says y should go to y to the p plus this expression, which I've written this way to emphasize that it's 1 plus a multiple of p. So you can pull out a p and then this thing, which is, well, you take p tilde, you apply the p power Frobenius coefficient by coefficient, and then you sub in x to the p for x. That has the same effect mod p as simply raising p tilde to the p power. These are, of course, different in characteristic zero, but they look the same mod p. So you get a factor of p in this thing, which I've sort of written twice here. And so this thing, this binomial series, if you expand it that way, gives you an infinite series which represents the image of y under a Frobenius list. And of course, the z thing should go to the inverse of this, which you can write as another series. But the main point is that this thing is not an algebraic expression. It really is a p-adic series, but it has some sensible convergence behavior, which makes the rest of the calculation work. Okay, and now there's some sort of Durand cohomology. So the Durand cohomology in this case is pretty explicit. So omega 1 is going to be my module of 1 forms on this affine curve. So it's going to be over a module over some ring R, which I didn't explicitly write down, but it's the ring in which the expressions I wrote down on the previous slide naturally live. It's going to be a module generated by symbols dx and dy modulo this, which is the formal derivative of the equation y squared equals p tilde of x. So then the cohomology I'm interested in is the quotient of x1 by the spans of the exact differentials. So formal expressions df, where f is something in my ring, and I formally differentiate with respect to x and y, just as in multivariable calculus. This thing turns out to be finite dimensional. I can explicitly write down a basis. I get some expressions like this and some expressions like this. These actually are two different parts that come from the pieces. I can think of this cohomology as being split by the hyperelliptic involution, which sends y to minus 1, fixes x. So this is the plus part and this is the minus part. I really only need the minus part, but you don't need to know that for now. So this is a vector. So I have, of course, this vector space is a finite dimensional vector space, which is produced as the quotient of two infinite dimensional vector spaces, the sort of maddening thing that mathematicians like to do. But I can explicitly write down a basis. And moreover, I can explicitly write down, given an element of omega 1, I can explicitly rewrite it as a linear combination of basis elements plus an exact differential. Essentially, what happens is if you write down something, there's a sort of successive simplification process by, if it has a large power of y in the denominator, then there's a sort of successive reduction method for reducing that power of y by carefully writing down exact differentials. So there's a nice algorithm to simplify forms and put them in terms of basis elements plus exact differentials. So you really can actually compute in this quotient, this finite dimensional quotient of two infinite dimensional vector spaces, really is something you can effectively compute in. And better yet, actually, all of this calculation is kind of algebraic. If you start with an algebraic form, which is what you get by writing down Frobenius and then throwing away the terms of high divisibility by p, so you write down an infinite series but then truncate it, you get some actual thing with polynomials, you can sort of roll down the complexity of the thing you've written down without having to introduce additional infinite series. So that's very handy for actually trying to compute this thing. It makes a difference in terms of complexity estimates. So you can compute an approximation to the Frobenius action on this vector space by applying a sort of truncation of the ring Frobenius lift to these basis elements. And what you get is an algorithm to compute zeta x in, I'm always going to write soft O, ignoring log factors here. I believe this typo I did fix from the last time I gave this talk. The time dependence is a genus to the 4 and n cubed, where n is the extension degree. These are bit operations, I think. And space is soft O of g cubed n cubed. But I only really know this for sure under the restrictions I gave. X is in the imaginary case, and p is not 2. Probably these are okay in general. So for p equals 2, So I should have I've written these guys' names more prominently. So for p not equal to 2, this was introduced by me. The case p equals 2 is due to Deneff and Farquharson, and they got, I think, like a g to the 5 here. And Dan Bertstein and I spent some time trying to figure out whether you can actually get that down to g to the 4. And I think we basically think it's true, but we haven't actually worked everything out yet. There's sort of two bottlenecks, and one of them we completely understand, and one of them we haven't actually straightened out yet. Comment for Dan. I think probably the issue is that they're writing down a Frobenius lift whose complexity depends on that other thing that we didn't straighten out. So if you fix that, then maybe we can get this all the way down. But we can talk about that later. In the real case where, so remember the imaginary case was the curve has one point at infinity. If there are two points at infinity, Michael Harrison of the Magma Group has worked out the algorithm, but his work is not published. It's in Magma. And I think you can even look at the Magma code if you have a copy of Magma, because it's not in the kernel. But he hasn't written out complexity estimates, so I can't judge for sure whether he's getting the right exponent here. So you can actually try these things out in Magma. In Genus 1, they've also been implemented in the open source system Sage. It's William Stein's system, but David Harvey did the calculation. Watch for his name a little bit later. This was intended for a different application. It's intended for the computation of global canonical heights of elliptic curves over Q, but they're not the Archimedean global canonical height. They're the p-adic global canonical heights, which show up in the p-adic analog of the Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture. So in the p-adic Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, there's a p-adic L function. Its order at the critical value predicts the rank of the elliptic curve, and the leading coefficient has some stuff including the p-adic regulator, which is computed using this p-adic canonical height. And the fact that this is related to computing in Moskowitz-Washchuk cohomology is in a paper by Mazur, Stein, and Tate, which is available online. Yeah, so I'll come back to that David Harvey's calculation in a moment because it has an interesting wrinkle. So this is more curves. So now I'm talking about new developments since, so 2001, 2002 is when that original stuff manifested. This is more recent. So this is a sequence of generalizations by Deneff Farquharson, and the final one is joint with Kastrick, who I guess is also a student of Deneff. Farquharson was originally a student of Deneff. So they've sort of come up with a very large generalization of what I just described. So hyperelliptic curves are pretty special, but you could talk about many more curves than that if you introduce what are called non-degenerate curves. So here's what a non-degenerate plane curve is. So you write down a curve, p of x, y equals 0. So you write down some polynomial, or maybe it can be a Laurent polynomial, so you can have negative exponents if you like. It doesn't really matter. The Newton polygon of this thing is the convex hull of the set of points ij, which correspond to a non-zero coefficient. And a non-degenerate curve is one in which the curve is itself smooth in GM2. So if you look at the part of the xy plane where x and y are non-zero, you have a smooth curve there. And you also insist that if you look at each side of the Newton polygon and you just take the terms on that side, you get something which has no repeated factors other than possibly monomials. So that doesn't mean that you get a smooth curve in the plane. It means that you get a smooth curve in a certain toric variety corresponding to this Newton polygon, for those of you who know what that means. So for instance, you can write down this equation, and this gives you a smooth curve in GM2 if this sort of discriminant type thing doesn't vanish. And if A is not equal to, oh, that should be plus or minus 2. Huh, that typo was in my previous version of the slides, too. In any case, if these things have no repeated factors, which means that this should be plus or minus 2, then you actually get something non-degenerate. So there's a few special values, but for a generic value of A, you get a non-degenerate curve, and that's the typical thing. Sort of, if you write down parameters, then generically you should get a non-degenerate curve. So if you were to write down the Newton polygon in this case, you would find that there's one interior lattice point, namely 2, 1. So the points are, right, Maybe I won't bother to write this out, but you can see what the points are there. 4 comma 0, 3 comma 0, 2 comma 1, 2 comma 0, 1 comma 1, 1 comma 0, and 0 comma 2. And if you draw what that looks like, you'll see it has only one interior point. So this describes a curve of genus 1. And in fact, if you know more about this theory, you can actually explicitly write down the Durham cohomology of this curve quite using quite simple equations. And that's why this is useful for computing zeta functions. Okay. So that's what I just said here. So you get a lot of input from the theory of toric varieties, which is good because you don't have to reinvent that. But what you do have to do is you have to figure out how to lift Frobenius. If you start with a non-degenerate curve over FQ, and you lift it, you can lift the equation to ZQ, but then you have to lift the Frobenius. The trouble is that you don't get to cheat and use one variable, have one variable lift trivially. For one of these things, you have to lift both X and Y to certain power series. And this makes life complicated. So what they do is they somehow reduce to doing a lift of a single object, which they can do with a Hensel's lemma and a Newton iteration to calculate it. But you get kind of bad constants. I think you might even get bad exponents, but I haven't really checked in a lot of detail. So there's a question which arises is, do you have a trick, as in the hyperelliptic case, to help you, which is, well, in the hyperelliptic case, what I did is I threw out extra points. Remember, I didn't have to throw out the points where y equals 0 in the affine plane, but I did, and it made life easier because then I could divide by y in key places, and it made it easier to lift Frobenius. In this case, if you try to do that, you end up having to invert some sort of resultant, and that makes the cohomology calculation more complicated. So there's a complicated trade-off that I don't know where to balance it. There's also a question. This is already not so easy to do in practice for curves. I think Verkaderin has done some experiments, and they're somewhat inconclusive. But there is some interest in other circles. I think maybe some people who are interested in mirror symmetry might be interested in two- and three-dimensional examples of zeta functions. And so there is some interest out there for doing higher-dimensional analogs. John Voigt is, I believe, interested, but maybe hasn't started too much thinking about how to do this. I mean, we've discussed it, but this is not about to be implemented. It's work under discussion. Okay, so speaking of higher dimensions, there is another method to go to higher dimension, which is something that I did with two undergraduate summer students last year. They came to me and were looking for a project and I said, hey, can you implement this algorithm to compute these zeta functions of surfaces? So here, X, I'm going to start out with a smooth hypersurface in P3. So straight P is some homogeneous polynomial. I want this to be smooth. But the trick here is I'm not going to compute directly on X or even on an affine piece of X. I'm actually going to replace X by its complement in P3. So instead of taking something out of X and computing with an affine thing inside X and something else, I'm going to take X out of something larger and compute with what's left over. Because this U, when you take a smooth hypersurface out of P3, you get an affine. You get a smooth affine, and its coordinate ring is pretty simple to write down. It's this ring, FQ adjoined W, X, Y, Z, and the inverse of P, but you have to take the part of degree 0. Because otherwise you would get a cone over you. The Durham cohomology of this is quite easy to write down because Phil Griffiths did it in the early 70s. So you don't have to think too much. He wrote down really nice formulas for computing with this. He was interested in Hodge theory, but we can borrow his formulas. So you lift P to a homogeneous polynomial P tilde, and then you have access to these Griffiths formulas to compute in cohomology, and you can lift Frobenius relatively easily. You lift W through Z as shown, and then you do a sort of series type thing, as I did before, to lift the inverse of P tilde. Again, you can do this out as a binomial series, or you can take a Newton iteration to help you with this. The point to carry away from this is that you again get a series which represents the lift of P tilde, but now this is the only thing that's complicated. These guys lift very nicely. So this is quite easy to implement. Because that Frobenius lift is so simple, I could sort of have two undergraduates who didn't actually know all that much algebraic geometry implement this over the course of a summer, and it really worked. It's not a very good idea in principle, because I went up from two dimensions to three. I'm computing on a threefold. So this sounds like a horrible idea. It's asymptotically much slower than either computing directly in FMP or doing Lauder's deformation method. But we were actually able to do it in some examples. So we got some degree four surfaces over various primes FP. This was partly motivated by an application in coding theory that was proposed by Philippe Volok, and partly by a question that was being investigated by Ronald von Lauck about finding K3 surfaces over the rational numbers with provably Picard number one and various extra conditions. So these zeta function calculations, so von Lauck was able to calculate these things by the hand method when p is equal to 2 and 3, but I think he maybe ran out of steam at about p equals 5. You could do a lot better with this technique, and as I said, this technique is kind of boneheaded, so the fact that you can go up to p equals 19 but not that much further is really because this is not the right method. It was just the easiest thing to implement. I should mention that Johann de Jong has implemented a generalized version of this, where instead of talking about projective three space, you talk about a weighted projective three space. And in fact, what you should be doing is thinking about non-degenerate surfaces in toric threefolds. Just like in the Castrix and Fraktur stuff, you should think about toric varieties. There are some, I mean, Johann's implementation is, there are some proof issues that are not completely done. That's something yet being out of time, is it? All right. Okay, so to finish, since I have 2 minutes plus whatever, you'll forgive me for starting a little bit late. To finish, this is the new stuff. So those of you who tuned out or, you know, had heard this talk before, maybe you should wake up, because this is actually something that happened in the past 3 weeks after I gave the last talk. Well, the story begins with something older. So in medium, this part of the talk is about what happens if p is actually not small. What if p is, you know, a prime instead of being a one-digit prime? What if it's a five-digit prime or a 10-digit prime or a 20-digit prime or maybe even slightly larger? The dependence on p in everything I've said so far is at least linear in p. It's known to be linear in p in a number of the cohomology situations, and it seems to be universally true. It's a little bit less clear in some other p-adic methods, but in any case, you know you have a polynomial dependence in p, so you're not a priori hoping to get, you're certainly not hoping to get p to be 2 to the 256 or anything like that, but you might try to get p a little bit larger, so there was a paper by Bostan, Gaudry, and Schost, who proposed a method for computing Cartier matrices for hyperelliptic curves where the time dependence is only soft of p to the 1/2. Rather than p. And that lets you get p to be quite a bit larger. So for instance, by using this plus some rounds of Skolz algorithm and then some baby step giant step, they had to sort of throw everything but the kitchen sink at this calculation, but they get a Jacobian order for a random curve of genus 2 over fp cubed, where p is about 2 to the 32, which I guess is about is a cryptographic size. Now, I should say, where does that p to the 1/2 come from? It comes from a method of the Chudnovsky brothers for accelerated computation of terms in certain recurrent sequences. So, for instance, if, say, capital N is less than p, you could compute n factorial mod p and times soft o of n to the 1/2 log p. If n is greater than or equal to p, you can do it much faster. But in any case, this is a sort of baby step, giant step. You have some recurrence, which involves, this can be a vector recurrence, so you have vectors and matrices relating to consecutive terms. So the sort of baby step is you compute, I mean, it really is sort of baby steps and giant steps. You figure out what you formally compute how to go from not one term to the next term, but one term to a much further away term. So you first figure out how to go two steps at a time, then four steps at a time, and then so on up to about square root of n number of terms at a time. And now you can take giant steps, and you can take those giant steps by you sort of actually take the giant steps using some of the fast evaluation techniques. I don't want to get into this, partially because I haven't actually worked through all the details myself, but it works. You can do examples. So David Harvey, who I mentioned before, who's a grad student at Harvard, was interested in applying this to computing p-adic canonical heights for elliptic curves. So the Cartier matrix is the reduction mod p of the Frobenius action on Monsky-Wachitzer cohomology. And David Harvey, so he hasn't, I thought this preprint was going to be available by the time I gave this talk. It's not, but he said it was okay for me to advertise this. I'm hoping this will be available in the next week or two. So I have his preprint, but it's not quite finished yet. He has a method for lifting this Chernovsky method to actually use it to compute Frobenius actions on hyperelliptic curve, on the Monsky-Wachitzer cohomology of a hyperelliptic curve. So not the mod P matrix, but the mod P to the whatever matrix. And the basic idea is that you sort of write out the action of Frobenius. You don't expand tilde P to the P, because that would give you O of P terms. You leave it sort of unexpanded and instead represent things as short sums of the form x to the pi plus j, y to the pk plus l, plus some coefficient, which I forgot to put in. So the point is that this is some sort of sparse representation, and then you have reduction techniques sort of both for the x terms and for the y terms. So he calls them horizontal and vertical reduction using the Chernovsky method to kind of bring everything into range. Harvey's preprint is only going to actually do this in genus 1 because his intended application is in genus 1 over FP. But there seems to be some hope in using this to compute Jacobian orders of cryptographic size for curves of low genus curves over FP to the N for low genus and low extension degree. So a challenge to the audience, and I think I'm making this to a particular person in the audience, is g equals 3, n equals 1 doable? G equals 2 maybe is too much to ask for, but g equals 3, n equals 1 is possibly within the realm of feasibility. I should say that the dependence on g and n is a little bit worse when you do this than it was, at least Harvey's estimates, which he hasn't worked out in detail, suggest that the dependence on g and n is a little bit worse than they were before. So for gearheads in the audience, the dependence on n may go from n cubed to n to the fourth. And the genus dependence may go up a little bit too. But I'm asking this question for small g and n, so it matters less. So that's... And you probably need to wait for David Harvey's preprint to do this, but as I said, it should be coming soon. So with that, I think I will stop.